Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, we'll be talking with John Stobart and Mark Rothery about their new book, Consumption and the Country House. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Thank you. Hello.
I was wondering if the two of you could start us off by introducing yourselves and telling us something about yourselves.
Yeah, hi. I'm a senior lecturer in history at the University of Northampton. I work on landed elites in various different guises, so mainly social, economic, and cultural history, although more of my more recent work has been on the political history of landed elites.
Hi, yes, it's John here. My research interests are very much in terms of retailing and consumption, and also, I suppose, the interface between those, the sort of the practices of shopping and the spaces of shopping as well. So I'm coming at our project from a slightly different angle. I was at Northampton previously, and now I'm at Manchester Metropolitan University, where I'm a professor of history.
Those two areas sound very distinct. I wonder if you could explain how it was that the two of you came together to write this book.
Okay, the kind of the origins of the project are as an ESRC-funded project, which we were both sort of working on. And it sort of brought together, as you say, these sort of two complementary sets of interest and I suppose experience and skills as well. So we're bringing slightly different perspectives to bear on the same kind of material. So it's a funded project to begin with, and from that grew a number of articles, and finally the book itself.
So you came together to write this book, and what was it about the subject that brought it about? I mean, there's been a lot written about country houses. Consumption is a burgeoning field. What is to be gained from studying both them together? Is it something that is distinct from ordinary consumption in the 18th century, or is it simply adding to a picture that we're currently filling out?
I guess the answer to that is kind of twofold, and Mark will fill in some things here as well, I'm sure. I think firstly, the conscious purpose of the project and of the book is to try to integrate elite consumption, if you like, the sort of the landed aristocracy, into a kind of a mainstream of consumption historiography, which in terms of 18th century England focuses primarily on a kind of a middling sort, and particularly an urban middling sort. So there are lots of things that we know about that as a group. And what the kind of the project was doing was sort of consciously drawing some of those ideas about that set of people and looking at those and how they played out for this sort of landed elite. Because previously the kind of approach to the country house and to landed aristocracy has focused on rather different areas. In terms of the country house, it's been perhaps a kind of art historical approach, which is fine, and there's lots of useful insights we gain from that. But it gives us a very particular sort of view on the country house as a sort of a treasure house of kind of art and collections, and of the owners of those houses as the kind of the connoisseurs and the collectors, rather than as consumers who might share a lot of motivations and a lot of practices with a whole bunch of other people. I don't know whether you want to add anything to that, Mark.
Yeah, I think much of the history of the aristocracy has come at the subject from an economic history perspective, and it's really been focused on the estates and the running of, the funding of, capitalisation of the estates. And in the period that we cover in this book, one big kind of narrative, for instance, is the rise of the great estate, the expansion in the size of estates, and their role in the agrarian revolution. But very few studies have actually taken us inside the country house itself. A lot of the social history of this kind is very descriptive. We get a kind of very generalized picture of a wealthy group of people who spent a lot of money were very powerful, entertained with, you know, these big lavish dinners and balls and so on. But it's all very sort of static, and it doesn't give us any kind of sort of nuanced understanding of that style of life, or of the or of some of the identities and patterns that kind of form the framework for those. So it fills a very important gap, I think.
And I think an important part of that is that kind of dynamism or animation that we're trying to bring to an analysis of the Country House. So rather than a sort of a set, static picture, it's consumption as a process. So there are kind of flows of things as well as things that are sat there. And I think that's an important contribution that we can make here. Plus the way in which doing that involves looking not only at the kind of the big ticket items, the furniture, the artwork, and so on, but also the rather more mundane everyday things that keep a house ticking over.
It really is a sense of the country house as an organic space in which people are living, and not the sort of museum pieces as we encounter them today, where everything is in a fixed place and is almost sort of almost fossilized or petrified, rather than a place where people are constantly changing their environments in a way that we could relate to today.
No, absolutely. And I think it's a real challenge for organizations like the National Trust to present a house in anything other than that kind of static way. There's certainly a move to try and do that, to kind of animate the house, to make it feel like there are people there or have just gone out, as it were. So what we're trying to do in the book does kind of tap into a sort of a broader agenda within the kind of the heritage sector, although, you know, the two are running in parallel rather than necessarily talking to each other directly.
I think it's also worth saying as well that there are quite often assumptions about studying elite groups that in some way it's quite straightforward and easy, because the sources are there, they're a literate group, and they left a footprint historically which is fairly straightforward to kind of delineate. I mean, obviously, I would say now that it was very difficult and it was a very tricky exercise, but actually getting to the level at which you can animate these houses, understand the complexities and the layering, the way that they're used, what they represent, and so on, is just as complex. So I think that's partly why people probably historians haven't really analysed this subject in this way before, because it seems like we kind of know roughly what went on in country houses.
Well, one of the things that stands out in your book is some of the challenges in terms of undertaking that analysis. And while your book does broadly address consumption in country houses in the 18th century, you focus in particular on three case studies of three Midland gentry families. And I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about those families and how representative they were for their time.
Sure. The three families that we focus on, and the reason for doing this is so that, as Mark suggests, that there's an opportunity to look at any particular situation in some real depth rather than just sort of skim over the surface, as it were. The three families then, it's the Lee family of Stoneleigh Abbey in Warwickshire. They're the wealthiest of the three families that we're looking at. They're the kind of the Mr. Darcys of our sample. They're sort of worth 10,000, maybe a little bit more by the end of the 18th century, and are living in probably the grandest of the three houses, which has a significant extension added to it, the West Range, just at the start of our study period in the 1720s. Second family are the Newdigates of Arbury Hall, again in Warwickshire. The principal character here is Sir Roger Newdigate, who's maybe the most well-known of the characters that we look at. He's MP for Oxford from 1750 to 1780, and he's quite a well-recognised sort of man of letters. He's a little bit less wealthy, but invests heavily in coal mines and canals on his estate. And at a peak, his income is sort of 8,000-9,000 per annum, perhaps. The third family are the Drydens of Canons Ashby in Northamptonshire. we're interested in two sets of people there. The sort of Edward Dryden, who does a lot of work sort of modernising the house at the start of the 18th century, and John Turner Dryden and his wife Elizabeth Dryden, who owned the house right at the turn of the 19th century. It's a much smaller property and a much smaller estate, income of maybe 2,500. So it's if you like, three different types of this kind of lesser aristocracy, major gentry sort of group. The extent to which they're representative is very difficult to know until you've looked at lots and lots of other families. But I think they're capturing certainly three different types of family that have maybe fallen a little bit sort of under the radar of studies, where we tend to focus particularly on the kind of the big flamboyant noblemen, the sort of the dukes of the realm, who are spending very, very lavishly. So we're looking at a group that is sort of one or two notches below that, and I think are certainly more representative, if that's the word, of a larger section of the landed aristocracy.
One of the things that you do at the start of the book is you talk a bit about the patterns and rhythms that emerged from examining these three families. And I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about what those patterns were. I mean, was spending just a regular everyday activity that never fluctuated, or were there differences, and was there any sort of pattern to the differences?
Yeah, there are patterns in this spending. So this isn't, you know, hugely wealthy families continually spending their money. There tended to be peaks, which we discuss in the book, peaks in spending at particular moments in the history of the family. And the biggest peaks occurred at the points of inheritance. So when one of the owners died, someone else inherited the house and the estate. They came into that estate and into the country house with the intention to imprint themselves in some way onto the fabric of the house or onto the structure of the house. The level at which this occurred it varied between different owners, and obviously it was facilitated or not by the level of wealth and level of debt that each generation inherited along with the house. But you see generally these peaks in spending across a fairly short period of time in comparison to the longer period of the book as people inherited the house. And when I say they imprinted themselves on the house, this was part of, you know, a more complex kind of semiotics, if you like, of lineage and family belonging. So they never really made the house their own, but certainly they altered it to their taste, to their interests and so on.
I think what we've got sort of running throughout these sort of peaks of spending reflect those kind of inheritance events, perhaps rather more than marriage, which is what we're often sort of told. But of course, underlying all of that is a sort of an unavoidable amount of spending that is to do with running the house, and that you just can't get away from. So that's that kind of sort of base flow, if you like, on top of which we get these sort of peaks of spending.
No, I was going to say that the notion of the peaks, the both of you describe it, points to what we were talking about a few minutes ago regarding the notion of these as lived-in spaces. These weren't just like walking into, say, a modern-day hotel room and you just make yourself comfortable. They did try to make the space their own. But again, going back to the income levels of the three groups in particular, the three case studies that you've focused upon, that they don't have the income to tear down and totally reconstruct. So there's a limitation in terms of what they can accomplish with their resources.
Yeah, that's right. And the build fabric and structure of a building like a country house in some ways is actually quite limiting. It seems like there's more space. There's perhaps more that you can do. But it can actually be a limiting factor. Another limiting factor as well as debt and income, though, were the values that seemed to come through in these levels of spending. An important principle on the part of most of the people that we've studied in these three families was one of thrift. So actually, each generation spends quite a small proportion of its annual income. Most of that income seems to have been invested back into the estate, or invested in things like the collieries that John mentioned. So Roger Newdegate had invested in. So they're spending a very small proportion of their income. Now, of course, the amount that they're spending on perhaps individual items like jewellery is many, many multiples of the annual salary of the servants that worked in these houses. So, you know, it is extensive in that sense, and in comparison to other social groups. But actually, in terms of the money that they've got, they're not really spending a huge amount of it on the kind of goods that people see in country houses when they go and visit them. And as John said, the majority of spending actually on the house itself went on the more mundane, everyday spending to keep the house running and functioning as a family home.
Those peaks can certainly take a family beyond its annual income, but because it's a peak that doesn't happen year on year, you can sort of, if you like, you can overspend one year and kind of make up for that the next year. So there are kind of rhythms in the spending that are accommodated within a kind of a much smoother flow in terms of income.
And that was something that both the two of you referred to in the book, is how, especially in the case of the Lees and the Newdegates, there was a perception of the need to live within their means on a year-by-year basis.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is part of the responsibility of a country house owner, an estate owner, that actually, in reality, they're tenants for life, if you like. They hold this estate and this house in trust. And actually, the law was set up so that this was the case as well, the system of strict settlement, which is far too dull to go into in any detail, meant that each owner really had restrictions on you know, what they could sell and what they could do with the money that they'd inherited. So there's a culture within which the estate should be passed on intact, if possible, you know, aggrandized from one that had been inherited. This value of thrift is to some extent gendered as well, in the sense that it was an important value for men in this period. It was a masculine quality, if you like, to be able to control one's finances. But we see plenty of women in this study doing, you know, managing to do that as well.
And yet, in spite of the discussion that you have in your book about the notion of everyday consumption, you do spend a chapter talking about the construction projects. And I was wondering if the two of you could talk about how that fits within the overall picture of consumption in the country house.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always, I was going to say a tension. I'm not quite sure that's quite the right word. But there is this sort of balance being struck between ambition to imprint one's own taste, one's own character, upon the property, and balancing that with kind of the everyday running of the house. And we highlight two or three projects in particular. I mean, one is the sort of Gothicization of Arbury Hall by Sir Roger Newdegate. He's really a pioneer of that as a sort of an architectural form, and we can see his own hand very clearly in terms of devising the plans and overseeing their execution. So it's very much a kind of a personal project and a personal identity almost being imprinted upon the house, certainly a personal taste being imprinted upon the house. Elsewhere, in terms of what the Lees are doing, there the sorts of spending are very much more directed at the interiors and the furnishings of the house. So it's a grand design in as much as they are creating particular sorts of living space within the house. Some of those spaces, of course, are for public display. Others are more private. Although that public-private distinction is a really difficult one, and one that's kind of relative to who you are, the time of day, who you're with, and so forth. But I think that's an important point to make in terms of that distinction between imprinting one's character and imprinting one's taste in terms of the building, which isn't an easy task, and imprinting one's taste and character and adjusting a house according to your needs and your sort of family circumstance by investing in furniture, rearranging furniture, creating particular environments. That's much, much easier to do. It's cheaper, still a lot of money, but it's cheaper. But it's also something that can be done within the framework of the house as it already exists. So there's that that kind of playoff between those two.
I think another impression, which is kind of nuanced by this research, another impression that you get from visiting country houses as well is the kind of the grand design kind of motif. You're quite often told who built this house according to what design, you know, when the house was established, which obviously, you know, it's very useful information. But it gives the impression that this, is, in a sense, was a kind of quite straightforward ground-up process where the house was built. A little bit of, you know, there was some change in style across time, but essentially what you're seeing is the vision of whoever it is that builds it, whether it's, you know, Roger Neadergate at Arbury or perhaps Edward Lee at Stoneleigh. As we've said, though, you know, this is a far more complex and, in a sense, a more difficult process to navigate for the owners. And what you see through the houses is actually a very complex sort of layering of identities. And if the country house is, you know, an expression of habitus, if it's an expression of the cultural identity and the cultural power of the aristocracy, it's a very complex, layered message, if you like, that's being sent. You find all kind of mixtures of styles, some Gothic, some classical. Some of the objects in houses, you know, would have been considered very fashionable in the period that they were purchased. Others would more seem to denote rank and lineage and the position of a family or an individual, you know, in history, if you like, in the history of that family. So they're very complex messages to decode. I wouldn't expect, you know, the National Trust to sort of embrace that complexity. I don't think you can do that on a sort of 1 or 2 hour visit to a house, but certainly looks at from this perspective, it is a very complex message to decode.
And one of the points you return to throughout the book is how that messaging was a very conscious part or very at the forefront of their minds oftentimes when they're engaging in consumption. This is not just a place to hang their hats. This is not just a place for them to go to bed. This is also a place where they are very much on display, perhaps only to themselves and their servants, but also, you know, oftentimes to the public at large. And there were certain expectations that came with that.
Yeah, and I think we can see that being imprinted upon different rooms in different ways. I think it's Stoneleigh Abbey, the Lees house, that's clearest. You've got a kind of the equivalent of a sort of a state apartment, which remains largely untouched from the 1720s when Edward III, Lord Lee, furnishes those rooms, right the way through to Mary Lee's death in 1806. There are some minor changes, but the character and the essential purpose of those rooms remains the same. They are rooms of kind of public display. They're showing the pedigree, the lineage, the status of the Lee family. The other side of the entrance hall, you've got another set of rooms that are constantly being changed. Each generation imprints their own taste, their own needs on those rooms. So we see a succession of kind of, if you like, refreshments of those rooms in terms of new furniture, in terms of things like musical instruments, board games and so forth being imported into the rooms. To make them much, much more sort of sociable spaces. Those are places where the Lees would socialise with their friends. The other rooms are for projecting a particular image. These are the rooms where you actually live, if you like, and where you socialise, where you enjoy life in the country house. So that's kind of spatial differentiation, I think, is a very important part of understanding the kind of complexity of the country house. Somewhere that's as big as Stoneleigh Abbey accommodates that quite easily. Smaller houses like Canons Ashby, for example, that's a bit more complicated, a bit more difficult to make those clear distinctions in terms of what particular spaces might be about. But even then, we can see attempts, certainly by Sir John Turner Dryden and Elizabeth Dryden at the end of the 18th century, to kind of carve out some of those sorts of differentiations in terms of what their dining parlour is about, a very sort of public-facing room, and their kind of drawing room, an upstairs room, interestingly enough, which was very much more about that kind of sociable living, had very sort of modern, inverted commas, fashionable furniture. So even in those smaller houses, there's an attempt to do this kind of spatial differentiation.
We've been talking a lot about the spaces in terms of a redesign. I'd like to shift the focus now to the topic of everyday consumption, which consumes a great part of the book. And here we see not just different patterns, because the focus is different, but we also see a oftentimes wider range of individuals making these decisions. And who exactly was involved, and what were they consuming, and in what ways was the consumption shaped by maybe different individuals, different needs, and different circumstances?
I guess here the thing to do to begin with is maybe just to sort of outline the kinds of things we're talking about in terms of this sort of rather more mundane everyday spending. That would include food and drink. It would also include fuel for heating the house, candles for lighting it, the costs of maintaining, the costs of cleaning the house, costs of making repairs, stocking the kitchen with equipment, and so on. So it's those sort of everyday things that are to do with how a house is run.
Quickly, could you speak perhaps a bit to the scale that we're talking about here? I mean, roughly how much are they consuming on, say, a monthly basis, or perhaps a weekly basis in terms of, say, food, fuel, and so forth?
That's a really difficult question to pin down, because the rhythms of spending here, there's a kind of a base flow, but month on month, there could be quite a lot of variation. It might account for something like a third of the spending overall, but that could vary quite a lot month on month, depending on whether the family's in residence, for example, or whether they're in their London house, or away on tour or something like that. But it also seems to reflect quite a careful bit of stock keeping, if you like, probably by the housekeeper in most instances. So there are sources that we've been using that indicate the level of stores held within some of these houses. And we can see a kind of a rhythm of spending that reflects the level of goods within those stores. So, how many candles have we got? Do we need to buy some more? How much tea is there? When do we need to replenish those supplies? There's obviously a very careful calculation going on. There's not sort of, we put in a regular order for candles and they come in every week or every month. It's much more of a sort of a measured process. And in that, I think it's the housekeeper that plays a crucial role. And I think one of the things we're doing here is highlighting some of these, if you like, other individuals and the role that they will play in terms of determining some of the rhythms and certainly some of the choices in terms of who goods might be acquired from. So the housekeeper, certainly at Stoneleigh Abbey and at Arbury Hall for the Lees and the Newdigates, has a great deal of scope in terms of determining who it is that they are buying, that she is buying, particular sort of provisions from on a sort of a daily, weekly basis. And they then present their accounts to the owner of the house, maybe quarterly, maybe twice yearly, usually quarterly. So they are determining the spending. They are engaging with particular tradesmen, and they're having their kind of accounts signed off and their spending reimbursed by the owner of the house. If we move a sort of a notch or two up from that, the steward is another key character in determining the kinds of interaction that these families and the houses that they kind of embody, in a sense, the interaction that they will have with tradesmen. And again, at the Lee family, Stoneleigh Abbey, that's certainly the clearest example we have of this. A guy called Samuel Butler, who is the steward of the house for several decades in the later part of the 18th century. He's engaging with tradesmen. He's the one who, for example, when there's a complaint made about the quality of furniture that comes into the house, it's him that engages with the supplier. It's he that corresponds, not the owner of the house, not Lord Lee. There's also plenty of evidence that they are in some ways responsible for monitoring the activities of workmen who are in the house, installing new furniture, doing repairs, whatever else it might be. So they are kind of key characters in sort of shaping and managing the house in a way that kind of represents or reflects the sort of role that we might expect the housewife to have in a kind of a gentry or a middling sort family. The kind of the household economy is the responsibility of the housewife, that's day-to-day management of the house. Well, here it's the role of the steward and alongside him the housekeeper. So these sort of servants, senior servants, playing a key role in terms of shaping consumption.
Going back to the proportion spent on maybe more conspicuous items and then sort of more everyday items, one kind of macro figure, if you like, for Sir Roger Needlegate at Arbury Hall, across the whole period, so this isn't a monthly accounting, but across the whole period of his account books that we have, which covers a long period of time, he spent 7% of his income, or his spending rather, on building, and 10% on food. So for all of the kind of grand statements that were being made through the redesign of Arbury Hall, all of the effort and spending that went into it, it was only just over half of the money that was spent on food. Okay, some of that spending on food was on, you know, things like exotic fruits and expensive and fashionable sort of teas and things like that, but a lot of the spending on food was actually, again, on just quite mundane, everyday items. So that everyday life actually accounts for a bigger proportion of spending than the building itself, if you like.
And yet there's also another important distinction that emerges in terms of spending patterns and spending habits that you talk about in the book, and that's gender distinctions, how you would have masculine and feminine spheres that were distinct as well, and different spending patterns within those as well. And I was wondering if the two of you could speak to that.
Yeah, gender is an important factor in terms of providing the limits, if you like, to the way that men and women behaved as country house consumers. Women in these houses were very powerful, very wealthy women, certainly more privileged than the majority of men in British society at this time, but they were part of a patriarchal system that still defined to a certain extent what the limits of their behaviour was, what the limits of their choices and autonomy were. So you see different types of responsibilities kind of channeled to men and women, and different types of identities expressed to a certain extent through their spending. And some of this is quite orthodox and what you'd expect. So men were more likely to collect books, to spend money collecting books, to spend money on the fabric of the building. architectural changes to the house, and so on. Men had more autonomy, in a sense, over their spending, and they were in what you might call kind of global overall control of the spending in the house. Women were more likely to be involved in the everyday running of the household. So the kind of things that we've just been discussing, the kind of everydayness of the country house, paying servants wages, interacting with the senior servants, perhaps buying the servants clothing and so on. And they had less autonomy, and they seemed to have, and they had less, you know, quite straightforwardly, less money to spend as well, less control over over spending. Within that, though, there are some nuances and some complexities, and it's far from straightforward in a gender sense. So the kind of things that men spend money on vary between different men, because they had different tastes and different interests and so on. That might be different men within the same family, or it could be between different families. So a good example, for instance, is Thomas Lee and his son, Edward Lee. Thomas wasn't, or doesn't seem to have been, very interested in collecting books. He spent more money on clothes and on dress and so on. Edward, by contrast, was far more interested in collecting books. He spent very little on clothes at all, and he spent a lot more than his father on building works and alterations to the house. That may be because of the financial situation of the family at the time, between those two owners, but it can't explain all of those distinctions. So really, in a sense, elite men had more autonomy about the way they express themselves as men, by the way they express their masculine identities. And you see those variations then coming through in the different kind of spending patterns. At the same time, we shouldn't stereotype women in the country house either, and the sort of the limitations that were placed on them. They spent large amounts of money, and they seem to have, they obtained and sourced goods from, in some cases, from different suppliers than their husbands had. So they worked, you know, they were operating in, to a certain extent, their own consumer kind of universe away from men. Another complication as well is in terms of single women. Not all of the women in this book were married. Or, you know, in the case of Elizabeth Dryden, she became a widow after her husband's death and had a lot more autonomy over her spending, where she was investing money and so on, albeit in very restricted context because of the debts on the estate at the time. But perhaps the best example is Mary Lee, who's the owner or the tenant for life of Stoneleigh Abbey between 1786 and 1806, and effectively had you know, complete autonomy and control over what was spent, what kind of goods were purchased, what was done to the house, and so on. And she's left quite a significant footprint on Stoneleigh Abbey in terms of the changes she made to the house and the kind of life that she lived there. I think it's worth saying that, you know, these aren't unusual examples because of rates of mortality in this period, although, you know, divorce was very, very, very rare. But because of rates of mortality, which are far higher than they are today, you know, many women were left single and in charge of the estate. Some of them married again, and therefore they're kind of re-entered into a patriarchal relationship and context and so on, but not all of them did. So Mary and Elizabeth represent, you know, a large number of country house women who were in control of finances and had a level of autonomy that we might not necessarily expect in women.
And what I think is particularly interesting when we look at Mary Lee in particular, but Elizabeth Dryden also, is the way in which a kind of a gender identity and a status identity become kind of mixed up together. So that things that we tend to think of as male areas of spending, on the estate, for example, then pass on to the woman. So are they male areas of spending that the woman is now engaged in. So is she engaged in male masculine spending? Or is it, and I think this is probably what we would argue, is it that there are these areas of spending that are to do with land ownership? Now, they're generally attributed to the man because in a patriarchal society, that's how the accounting and the legal process works. But actually, they're not necessarily kind of masculine areas of spending. They're areas of spending that are to do with status, to do with land ownership. And whether it's the man or the woman that takes those on, kind of is almost a demographic accident as much as anything else. Mary's left as the only person who can inherit the estate. She takes on all of those things as well.
I did find Mary and Mary Lee and Elizabeth Dryden two of the most fascinating individuals in that book for that very reason, because there you're seeing almost a centrifugal separation of the duties of the head of the household and the more specifically masculine gendered expenditures, because they had to do the one as the heads of the estate or life tenants, if you will, but they did not necessarily have to engage in a lot of, or maybe could not have engaged in a lot of the more specifically masculine gendered spending habits of the of that particular group of society.
Yeah, Elizabeth puts a quite clever kind of inflection on this when, after her husband has died and they've spent beyond their means, they're one of the, you know, few people in this book who do this. And Elizabeth is left with the debts and corresponds with the suppliers who are asking her to settle the bills that have been left after her husband's death, and essentially claims, you know, perhaps, you know, truthfully, but certainly in a very kind of calculated way, it seems, that these are her husband's debts. She didn't have the power to make these decisions, so they've come to the wrong person, and they should, you know, they should understand that she's neither got the income or actually the ability to pay these debts. So those gender identities could be used in quite useful ways sometimes by these women as well, as they were undoubtedly by men in perhaps equivalent situations.
And the other aspect, of course, to, I think that needs to be kept in mind is the degree to which, when these women did engage in that spending, how sometimes it was filtered through their servants. So if they were playing that role, they might be working through the steward or through, in the case that you describe of dealing with, say, horses and carriages, they're you know, dealing with suppliers through the groomsmen.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the specific interaction that is going on between the spending that's happening in Mary Lee's name and the actual sort of tradesman who's supplying those goods or services. Yeah, I think it's clearly not Mary herself who is going along and ordering the carriages or the harnesses or so forth. The carriages maybe, but probably not all the harnesses and whatnot. Yeah, the groom is involved in that. And as we said before, the steward takes on a large role in terms of the kind of the day-to-day interaction with tradesmen. But we need to be a little bit careful, because that's a role that Samuel Butler, the steward at Stoneleigh, that's a role that he fulfilled for Mary's brother, Edward, the fifth Lord Lee. So it's not just a question of Mary as a woman not engaging with these tradesmen. It's a question of a landed aristocracy not engaging with these tradesmen necessarily in a direct sense. Now, I think there's clearly evidence that Edward Lee, for example, the fifth Lord Lee, is going into bookshops, is browsing, is ordering, specific items and so forth. He is, if you like, shopping in that sense. Equally, there's evidence that Mary is doing that with some of the things that she's acquiring. But for a lot of these things, they are dealing through a senior servant, or maybe they're dealing with tradesmen sort of via correspondence, for example. So there's a sort of a variety of arrangements that cut across these kind of gender divides and are maybe structured more by the nature of the goods that are being bought than necessarily the identity or the gender of the person who's doing the ultimate buying, you know, who's paying the bill.
You bring up one final major aspect of the book just now, John, which is the discussion you have about the suppliers and the spaces where consumption took place. And I was wondering if you could, if the two of you could speak a bit to that, the, you know, who these people were, from whom they were purchasing these goods, and where this consumption did take place, because a lot of this could not take place in the country house or on the country grounds or sometimes even in the immediate environment. It had to go much further afield.
Yeah, I think there's a kind of a myth of a sort of a self-sufficient estate, which is just that, it's a myth. I mean, there are a lot of things that an estate could supply in terms of building furniture, in terms of food, in terms of drink, but equally there's a huge amount that, of course, it couldn't supply, from things like tea through to clothing, through to carriages, silverware, or, you know, you name it. There's a huge amount of things that needed to be bought in. Some of those, of course, were acquired from the immediate area around the country house. So it's a major economic sort of beneficiary to the locality. You've got sort of anything from blacksmiths and masons through to the people who are supplying the provisions via the housekeeper. All of them are benefiting in some way from the presence of the country house and the owners in the country house doing that spending. The families that we've been able to analyse their spending in kind of detail, the Lees and the Newdigates, the vast majority of the suppliers that we can identify are in London. A huge proportion of those that we can identify, it's sort of 75% or so of the suppliers and of the goods are coming from London. So it's a major role that that London is playing in the supply of these places as well. And the ways in which those relationships might be built would be many and varied, depending, again, I think, very much on the character of the goods being acquired. So some might be dealt with largely by correspondence. Some undoubtedly involved visits to the shops themselves. I've already sort of alluded to Edward the Fifth Lord Lee visiting shops, bookshops in London, and we have sort of letters that kind of indicate that he's been kind of browsing the shelves and noting down some of the volumes available. We know from Sir Roger Newdigate's diaries that he's a terrific walker. Would walk the streets of London, would walk his estate. He walked an enormous amount, and we've got some of the itineraries almost that he would follow. And they take in a variety of venues, but amongst those are shops that he's dropping into to leave a watch to be mended, for example, or to look at some silverware or whatever it might be. So being there in person is tremendously important. And that kind of access, direct access to London suppliers, is very, very important. But of course, it's made an awful lot easier because London isn't necessarily a place that's a long way away. Clearly, it's a long way from where the country houses that we've studied, where they're located. It's 100 miles or so. But each of the families has a house in or near to London. So some of the year, in the case of Mary Lee, maybe 9 months of the year, she's spending in a London house. So local spending in that sense is in London, or in her case, it's in Kensington. And to give an idea of the sort of the magnitude of that, she spends something like £1,300 just on things like meat, poultry, fish, candles and so forth amongst the shopkeepers in Kensington. So it's a huge kind of input. That's over about a sort of a 5-10 year period. So there's a huge input into that kind of local economy. But that local could be Kensington, it could be London, or it could be Stoneleigh or Arbury. So where a particular family is located would impact on, you know, where that spending takes place, but also the sorts of relationship that would be experienced between the shopkeeper and the landowning shopper, if you like.
Two things I'd add to that. I think in terms of the sort of the regional spatial dimension here, we need to be very careful. As John said, the majority of suppliers we identified were in London. It's much more difficult because of the sources to find them in the local regional area. Mm-hmm. But Arbury Hall and Stoneleigh Abbey weren't really that far apart. They're spatially pretty close to each other.
About 15 miles.
Yeah. Yeah. Although some of the suppliers in the local area, or the regional area, if you like, overlap, they don't really share in the same kind of regional cultural consumption, it seems. In terms of who they're purchasing these goods from, they seem to move in different circles. Perhaps they didn't like each other, so they just avoided each other and didn't go to the same people. It's quite interesting in that regional context. They're actually going to quite different people. I suppose on the bigger scale as well, one thing that's not absent but not very conspicuous in either of those houses is the kind of broader colonial and imperial context, which we're being led to believe increasingly was very important in the country house, that they were expressions of this wider colonial world. And what we actually see is a much stronger kind of imprint and footprint from Europe and from the Grand Tour and so on. That may be something specific about these two families. It does seem interesting that across this period, when the empire is really expanding quite significantly, becoming more and more important in terms of trade and so on, that doesn't seem to be represented in two houses.
Yeah, I mean, we have things like, I mean, they are drinking tea and coffee, they are buying sugar, of course they're doing this, so they are engaged in that kind of colonial enterprise in that sort of way. But in that sense, so is everybody else in the country. These are not, and that's an interesting thing. It kind of links their consumption to that of other social groups, of course. But it's not, as Mark says, it's not a question of these being sort of places that are profoundly influenced or consciously influenced, I think, by empire or by ideas of sort of the exotic. I mean, Mary Lee in her room at Stoneleigh Abbey has some Chinese wallpaper and some small kind of Chinese landscapes. There's a few bits and pieces of Chinese sort of porcelain figurines, but it's a very small element in a much bigger sort of English stroke European and primarily English, I think, material culture that seems to characterise Stoneleigh Abbey in particular, I think.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. Before we go, I was wondering if the two of you could tell us what you're working on now.
I've just finished a mini project, I think I'll call it, on the younger sons of the landed gentry, the men who didn't inherit the estate, thinking about their masculine identities. And there's an article that I've written, which is actually about masculine anxiety and the kind of the anxiety that was caused by not being able to reach or potentially not being able to reach the level at which one was, the social level at which, one was sort of born into. And I'm also involved in a project with another historian, a potential project, if we're funded, on the masculine identities of a series of British prime ministers from Robert Walpole through to Benjamin Disraeli, thinking about their own, reflections on themselves, if you like, but also the way they're represented in biographical literature and in the press, and how this evolved over time.
I'm working currently with a Marie Curie fellow who's at Manchester Met with me on a project looking at comfort and the country house, kind of a comparative study of England and Sweden. So this builds on some of the interests that we develop in consumption in the country house looking at the idea of comfort in a kind of a physical sense. So what makes these places comfortable and how are they described in those sorts of terms? But also laying alongside that an idea of comfort in a kind of an emotional sense as well, a much more traditional sense of the word as a sort of a consolation. So the comfort that you might get from friends or from writing letters, from interacting with your family, but also as well the way in which comfort might be something that is counterintuitive, in as much as you can be physically very uncomfortable in a particular dress or a particular or sat on a particular chair. So physically it's uncomfortable, but actually it's conforming, it's the proper thing to do, and therefore you are socially comfortable, if that's the right word. But that's an idea that we're kind of kicking around at the present in this notion of comfort in a broader sense.
Those sound like very interesting projects. Well, I wanted to thank both of you for taking the time out of your schedules to speak with us today about your book, Consumption in the Country House. I hope the two of you have a wonderful day.